To it. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in again. This is Mike Lafferty of the Vigilance Press Podcast. I have two special guests this week, Green Ronin freelancer Jack Norris.
Hello.
Hey, Jack, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me, as always.
And we have James Dossi of Shadow Chaser Studios. How you doing, James?
Hey, just in here subbing for Dan since he had cat trouble.
Yeah, Dan had some feline issues. He's out fighting the Kolrathi Armada, apparently. And so we are going to postpone the actual play podcast until hopefully tomorrow night or maybe the night after. And just going to address some DCA rules questions on the forum. So we want to get into that. We can – let's see. We had a question about Shapeable. Mm-hmm. And let's see. All right, and this is from Merkglow. And it's not clear. Mark Glow asks, could you ask him how he thinks shapeable option of area effects should work? As it stands, it does not say how much the effect may be stretched, and unless it's stretched fairly thin, 30 cubic feet is still pretty small. So, okay, Jack, what do you say?
Well, you know, he's not wrong. 30 cubic feet is not a lot. I think I've actually thought about this a while, and I think that, like, some of the things in third that we're seeing maybe a little more so than with second are, there's a lot of sort of GM and player sort of mutual contract involved there. Personally, I'd probably let somebody stretch it fairly thin. As long as they didn't feel like they were trying to be abusive. Like, you know, if somebody was going to, like, you know, pulled out the calculator and, you know, figured out, you know, I can make, like, something, you know, just a fraction of a millimeter thick, and then I can make out tendrils that I can use to, like, you know, attack everybody in the city selectively or whatever. That I would probably not allow that. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I think the question is the effect you're looking for. If you're gonna, like, for example, on attack, I mean, if you got an energy blast, shapeable, I mean, you don't really need a wide effect to hit somebody with it. I mean, you're just trying to basically reach them with that damaging effect. And if you want to be able to form it into, like, you know, a cool shape, you know, a circle or a cross or whatever. Another example that might be a little, maybe a better example would be, let's say you get a guy who's, you know, can form like ice, you know, basically create ice like Iceman. You know, if you want to do like an inch thick sheet of ice, you know, across, you know, an area, you know, you could do that. I think that would be a lot. I mean, I would personally allow that. But then again, if somebody also really wanted to make a 6-inch ice wall, you know, it's going to be a smaller area. I do think it's a pretty small effect. I think you're getting a lot of utility out of the ability to shape it exactly how you want it. So I think GMs, you know, if somebody takes that, I think, you know, my advice would be recognize you're not giving them a ton to play with. So let people really have some fun with the shapeable aspects of it, and, you know, let them stretch it to get a little more bang for their buck.
Quick question for you. Excuse me, sorry to jump in, sure. But when would you choose to use, like, a shapeable area as opposed to, say, just taking an area effect burst and then making it selective? Couldn't you essentially determine a shape within that area if you did that?
You know, I think that's actually – it's kind of like there's two different ways of doing it, and I think you're going to – the shapeable selective area is going to be more – it's going to cost a little more, but it's also going to be more effective. So you're going to kind of get your money's. You're going to kind of get your money's worth. Honestly, for me, I think the shapeable effect, at least I kind of feel, is the sort of thing I'd see with the relatively close range effects. You know, like, let's say you had a guy who had like an energy field around him that he could, you know, form things out of, but it was still a field around his body. You know, I might let him – that might be something where you might have fun with a shapeable effect, you know, where you could shape it into – you know, you could cover one guy but then not somebody else. Or you could – but you don't really want or need that really, you know, large area. You're actually you want more of the versatility. I also think that might be kind of fun to do something like Shade the Changing Man back – at least back in the day. I'm not sure what his current status was, but when he was using – his meta zone vest that he had, you know, there was some playable, you know, some elements of him having sort of like illusions and such that were like around his body and made his body look weird. He could make himself look a little bit bigger and a little bit smaller. And part of that could just be illusion, but I could also see you doing sort of like a shapeable illusion or something where you could say, you know, I want to make myself look a little bit different. I mean, I think it's not actually an extra that I think you're going to see getting a whole lot of use. I mean, I think it's good to have the option in there, but I don't think it's something that would get a lot of use. I think a lot of times when people are looking at doing shapeable effects, what they actually want is area effect and selective. And but that said, I mean, I can definitely see, I guess I kind of count it like, switch system references here for a second. You know, Wild Talents breaks all its powers up into attack, defense, and useful. And useful is a thing that's really not attack or defense. And I kind of feel like shapeable on a power is something kind of maybe that would have that sort of useful quality, where maybe you're like, well, why would I want to do use shapeable? I mean, let's say you're, you know, trying to stop the BP oil spill, and you've got a power that can generate a shapeable force field or whatever. And you're like, well, hey, with a shapeable force field, I can go right down there and I can literally make something that will plug this exactly. It'll fill in whatever cracks, you know, as long as it can cover the area, I can do that. Is that going to have a real like in-game combat effect a lot of times? Maybe not quite so much, but, so I would say it's more in that regard, sort of a special effect power. I also think, like I said, you know, you can have some fun with it with, you know, if like close attacks, like maybe if you have like a speedster variant where, you know, I can punch everybody around me, but I can selectively do it. Maybe if you have a guy who can't, you know, necessarily cover a really wide area with that. But then again, that also runs into the question you're asking yourself is, well, how much are you going to let it stretch? I think that definitely you have to exercise some control or it can be really easily abused. But I think at the same time, you know, it's not a huge area, so you can have some, which also leads to, if somebody was looking at a house rule for it and they wanted to increase, you know, they decided that's too small and they wanted to, you know, increase the area by a little bit, I don't think they'd necessarily be losing. I don't think they'd be breaking anything by increasing the area by a little bit either. I mean, I haven't really like crunched those numbers, but I'd be real surprised to find if somebody said, you know, I let it be 60 instead of 30 square feet and my game fell apart. I doubt that would be the case, but it wouldn't be like, you know, some of the things we've seen with, like, you know, I think even with second edition, as much as I loved it, had some powers and abilities you kind of had to really, the GM really had to sign off on, or, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the guy's got, you know, a private army of characters he can use to just beat everything, or, you know, whatever.
Oh, hey, while we're talking about Shade the Changing Man, he apparently is back. As of August 2010, Hellblazer number 268, he returned as a supporting character for John Constantine.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I always liked Shade. He was always
anyone who wears a costume called the Madness Vest is cool, yes, in my
book. Well, and he was one of those wonderful sort of, you know, like crazy, you know, like here's a guy who I'm not saying he was on drugs, and I'm not saying that the guy, you know, when they were created, the creators were on drugs when they made him, but it wouldn't surprise me to find out that when your power is basically making people who look at you have a bad trip, that's pretty, that certainly suggests a certain, that was a character that could only really be created at a particular time with a particular mindset. But I also
think that's the kind of characters that's unique to comics. I mean, yeah. The visual medium where it's constantly shifting like that. I mean, recently in movies you can do things like that, but nobody's done it because it requires too much a leap on the behalf, you know, on the part of the viewer to really understand what's going on. But I think in comics, that's one of those characters that totally works in comics, but just is really nearly impossible to make work anywhere else.
Shade was also neat too because he worked as a sort of like wacky regular mainstream hero, and he also worked as a Vertigo character. Because I mean, I remember back when he was even in the Suicide Squad for a while. You know, I mean, they could, you know, you can, by tweaking the character somewhat, you can make him fit into various things. I mean, you know, before they did the Vertigo split, he was just a fairly wacky, didn't show up all that often DC Comics character. And then, you know, then they gave him his own title in Vertigo, and they really played up the whole, you know, what does it mean to be insane? And, you know, what does it mean? You know, what's the nature of reality and all that stuff? And, like, the meta zone.
That reminds me, is Constantine in the DCU or in Vertigo these days?
As I understand it, Constantine is kind of both. I believe everybody else is back in the DCU.
Aren't they trying to fold Vertigo back into the DC universe? Isn't that
Vertigo's like, basically been pulled back in? I think the big issue that I've heard with Constantine is less about, they're not sure where they want to put him, But I'm a couple months behind on Hellblazer, but I have been reading it pretty much since the get go. John's currently going through, like, he's currently getting married, and there's like a whole plot line involving that that's been building up over a long period of time. And I thought I read somewhere, but I couldn't point exactly to where, that DC was kind of wanting that storyline to be resolved and deal with everything before they even think about trying to fold him back into the DCU, where, you know, somewhere like Sandman's been over for years. I mean, if they want to put Sandman back in, they want to have Death show up in Action Comics, I mean, they can kind of just do that.
She did this month, didn't she?
Exactly. Yeah, she did this month. And, you know, I know there was a, you know, a brief uproar about that, but, you know, for me, it was all about, you know, the Action Comics crew has been doing such a great job with that whole Lex Luthor storyline that just is just hysterical and really fun and just over the top and wacky. So, you know, I have a lot of trust for that creative team to if they want to, you know, if they want to put Death in an issue, that's fine.
Let me break in for just a second. We had another question on the thread about growth and shrinking, but we weren't sure what to do because it wasn't real specific. I did a search and I found a pretty recent topic of Sunday over in the DCA forum. I'm going to start off with the first post just by Mr. Morrison because he seems to kind of sum it up. His first post ends, "My concern is that the trade-offs in growth seem awkward. Plus one for strength/stamina every rank, minus one defenses every two and some other stuff. I'm just having trouble making it work well in builds, especially if I only want to use a little bit of growth." So do you have any thoughts on that, Jack?
If you only want to use a very little bit of growth, like really you're talking about you just want a guy who's 7 or 8 feet tall. Mm-hmm. I'm actually thinking having played around with some various builds and being a big fan of sort of in earlier editions of going ahead and doing the whole, I'll just give a guy a level or two of permanent growth. I've actually been having a lot better luck in third, just giving like a feature to reflect a guy being tall and heavy and then just giving him strength and saying, look, you know, he's big, but he's not a giant. You know, he's like a big guy. But for lower levels in growth, let me go ahead and pop that up and take a look at it myself while I'm trying to sort of muse.
Why don't I send you the link over Skype?
Actually, I just found it, but thank you. But I think there is definitely some, I mean, I think there's some balance issues with that. I think if people are recognizing I think there's a lot of different fixes. I mean, I do know actually that one character in, that I've seen a build for doesn't even have growth for a character that can grow because there's no real evidence that he gets any stronger. He just gets bigger. So he just bought it as elongation. It's like, he can grow big and then he can like, you know, he can grab people at a length, at distance or whatever, you know, so he has an elongation effect, which is his growth power. And I think actually somebody even comments on that here. J.D. Rook on the forum does. And that's not a bad way to do it. I know a lot of people – I mean, I actually think growth and shrinking work pretty well. I do recognize there are, you know, a few issues. It's a little – there. I definitely would have – like, okay, this is – it would take some getting used to because it's not packaged the way it used to be. In that case, I also really recommend what I saw a lot of folks do back in the day with first and definitely second was I know a lot of people were not exactly happy with the way super speed was done. People just didn't quite like how it was done. They, you know, different people didn't like different things about it. And what a lot of people did is they just went ahead and rebuilt it. You know, they took a combination of quickness and speed and, you know, improved initiative as an enhanced feat in the, you know, and certain extra abilities in the fashion that they chose to do so. And made their own version of it. And I think growth is definitely, I mean, you can take enhanced strength and stamina and, you know, you can, you know, try, I mean, I think the trick there is tying it to the, you know, to the penalties is really the question that we don't, you know, there's not a lot of, but I mean, you could treat, you know, you can, you know, limited, for example, would be an example of how to work with that work, or if it's not, or if it's just a little bit of growth, that might just be a quirk.
Jack, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Let's get some nuts and bolts. Let's say we were all high. And we decided to play a Super Friends game from the 70s. And I wanted to play Apache Chief.
All right.
How would you stat Apache Chief?
I would definitely use growth for him.
I would definitely use growth for Apache Chief. Apache Chief is one of those guys I would definitely use growth for. I don't have my.
For me, I think the big change between him, and I'm sorry to jump in, but my big thing is he changes size.
Yes.
And it's not like he's always big. And I think this question more often comes up with people trying to build a character who's always big. And mm-hmm. I think for them, Jack's solution of making it more of a feature is, and especially if it's just like one size increase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like one size increase. But I think for somebody like Apache Chief or what was the Justice the Legion of Superheroes character?
Giganta?
No. Legion of Superheroes, the future.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. I think they work better when you have a shifting set of numbers where you can actually, you know, go for something like growth.
Or Giant Man and Ant Man, you know. I mean, to switch companies for a second. I mean, definitely guys who would, you know, their thing is that they change size. I mean, for example, Plastic Mine at some point, a few times, has actually made himself huge. But I really, it's just there's no real evidence that it's anything other than just elongation. It's him basically ballooning himself out to be like, you know, to be big, and maybe, you know, moving some stats around because I believe he has a small pool to do that if I remember correctly. But yeah, I mean, I think that's another, I think another thing too, I actually did do a couple like big characters, like always big, you know, I did one, for that I can think of off the top of my head for Heroes and Villains. And, there is,
you want to tell us who that was, Jack? I don't want to get you fired. I'm sorry. Just go ahead. Continue.
Yeah, freelancers are not going to fire me. They're just not going to hire me anymore, which is, you know, just as bad. I think, though, you know what? I've already said this. If you guys are up for it, when the Heroes and Villains actually comes out, I will gladly go through all the characters I did and talk and make commentary on all of them. Like when they come out, I'll even do a podcast of it. I will go through the guys I did and be like, here's my thinking. Here's what I do. I'll give them kind of like the mini Catman treatment for all of them. And once we're closer to having that out, because actually I think that would actually be a lot of fun.
Do we have a firm release date on that yet?
I've heard some like rumblings that it's getting there. I mean, I haven't heard, you know, they haven't like said, hey, by the way, you know, look for it next week or anything. I will say that I don't think this is really spoiling anything. I will say I was shocked by just how fast once you're in those final stages that you can get the PDF out. That Green Ronin can get the PDF out. I might not be able to get the PDF out as fast as I could. But I mean, they were really like, I was pretty amazed when, you know, DCA was a good, you know, the DCA PDF was out really fast. I mean, it was, and actually, that's actually been, I mean, that might even be a thing about just PDFs if you've got a good operation, because now that I think about it, I think the same thing happened with Smallville with Cam Banks and Margaret Weiss Productions was, you know, I was hearing people talking about, you know, playtesting and other things. And then, I mean, a couple days later, you know, PDF is available for sale. So, I think people are, you know, used to that sort of older release schedule where they haven't heard anything about it yet and they're thinking it's going to be months and months and months. I don't know. It could be a lot sooner. You know, I don't have a date for it, but I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I know that the Amazon date is complete crap, the December 7th that they just arbitrarily threw up there. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if it made that date, it wouldn't surprise me. Well, at least if the PDF made that date, not that the book does.
I did see one person ask a question. I don't think anybody official answered it. Mm-hmm. But the Peanuts Gallery addressed it. But you know, what do we know? They somebody asked if they were waiting to put out both books at the same time.
No,
and I don't think that's the case. They're planning to recently release them one after the other, right?
I mean, just to give a little brief peek behind the curtain that I don't think anybody's going to have any problem with. The way this works is we basically write them. You know, we get the outlines and the characters. We research them, we write them, we stat them. They'll go through a couple different iterations of editing and such. And then at some point they go at least once to DC for approval. And it may go, you know, more than once. And John recently admitted that, you know, volume one was sent back for some changes. So I don't think I'm spoiling anything by just repeating what he said.
No, he said that on the forums.
Yeah, he was pretty clear about that. And, you know, of course, and then DC was having restructuring issues with their creative stuff at the time. So that took a little longer. And then they get sent to us. We make changes, you know, of course, then things have to be laid out. Art has to be selected. So, you know, while both Heroes and Villains 1 and 2 are at some point along those process, you know, one is sooner than second than two, and one will be out before two.
Well, that would make sense, because if it was the other way around, that would just confuse people.
That would be really confusing. And I can sort of see the, and I can see the appeal kind of having two books because of the alphabetical, just the fact that it is alphabetically laid out. But at the same time, I also am kind of like, you know, I mean, there is the joke about, I guess you're only going to fight people from, you know, half the DC universe alphabetically for the first, for a few months there. But at the same time, I think there's also, you know, and I've said before, I think there's going to be a lot of utility for folks. Like people who keep asking for, you know, I want a power, you know, I really want a powers, you know, book. I'm like, well, you know, we're, if you want just scads and scads of power, examples, you're going to get them. There's going to be just tons and tons of stuff. And also something that I was really, and I think I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but one thing I really liked about the new system, and I mean, to some extent, this has been always true of Mutants Masterminds, is the fact that I saw people occasionally do something different than I would do to get the same effect, and the cost and everything would come out the same, but we would just go at it slightly differently. And, and it would usually be minor things like features. Like, for example, you might have a guy who's, I mean, this is probably my best example. You might have a guy who's got like a feature, 1 point feature fur, and it protects him against the cold because he's furry. And somebody might take that exact same character and do, you know, fur as the name of the power, and then buy immunity to cold. For they both cost the exact same thing. And there were a few times of certain builds that I at least, you know, I would see that across, you know, different ways to get to the same thing. And I mean, as I understood, I think we all kind of, I like those, and I think they pretty much got left in as more as features than as bugs, that there are multiple ways to, there are multiple paths to get to the same destination with a lot of this stuff, which I think is great, because I think that people, I mean, that's kind of, there's been a discussion a few times, people ask about, you know, why do you give some guys, you know, higher fighting, and you give some guys close attack, and you give some guys this and that, and, you know, I've given my reasoning behind it, and I know that not every one of the guys who worked on it shares the same reasoning, you know, but mine was just that it gives you an opportunity to take characters who've improved over time and give them easy scale back points if you want to scale them back to an earlier version of themselves. And also to me gives a sort of a illusion of growth when in reality it's just me sitting here and standing with the character. But at the same time, some people, you know, won't do that. And also sometimes it won't work for certain characters. There's no real need for example, for the new Blue Beetle to have a, you know, a nuanced build of development, because he really hasn't been, he's pretty much the way he is from when he appeared to now. But you might see that with, say, somebody like Batman. You know, if you want to scale Batman back to his, like, the Frank Miller year one appearances, you can get pretty far by just, you know, knocking a few points off close attack and a few points off some skills and a few points off range attack, and, you know, you're pretty close. I mean, right there, without even having to do a major league overhaul of the character. Which, you know, especially got a guy who's got as much stuff on his character sheet as Batman, that's kind of nice. But,
yeah, there's a lot of stuff on there.
Yeah, he's definitely the apex of advantage and skill oriented guys. I don't think I've seen a single character in either book that approaches that. I mean, he is really, like, I think people assume Batman would be at the apex of that, and he is. I mean, I can't think of a guy who's like, you know, oh, you think Batman has a lot of points and advantages? No, he really is, especially with all of the points and equipment that he has. He really, and the fact that he's got like the wealth and all that stuff. He really, he is really the example of how you want to, if you want to build the guy who, I'm not going to take any powers, but I want to be able to, you know, hang out with the big boys who've got powers. He's definitely one of the models to look to. And he probably arguably the model to look to, but, yeah, so I don't know when it's coming out, but hopefully very soon. I mean, I'm super psyched to see it myself. I mean, I want to see the whole book all laid out with the art and everything. And you know, I also John was sort of, I haven't seen it, but John was saying very, very complimentary things about the cover art for the new Mutants Masterminds third, the actual like non DC.
Oh yeah, Steve Kinch mentioned that too.
Yeah, Steve mentioned it, and John mentioned it, and he didn't tell me who he showed it to, but they showed it, I guess, to somebody from a different art studio than did the cover, and they were like, this is amazing. So it's getting a pretty much universal acclaim for just being a gorgeous cover.
Do we know who the artist is?
No, I don't. You know, I really don't know who the artist is. I mean, I'm I'm guessing that it probably is somebody that we're, you know, that I'm, that you're not probably completely unfamiliar, that we're not completely unfamiliar with. I'm guessing it's maybe some guy who's done some of the earlier stuff, but I really don't know who it is. Nobody stepped forward to say, hey, that's me. So that's,
I know that the first two core rule books both had the same artist, right?
Yeah.
Actually, guys, I have the exclusive on that.
Oh, yeah.
It's Thomas Kincaid.
Well, Thomas Kincaid is doing the new one?
Thomas Kincaid, the Artist of Light. Yes, he's doing the cover.
Oh, cool.
I'm lying to you. That's a joke. Sorry.
Stop that. You don't know this information. That's just like telling a 5-year-old that the sky is blue because there's a big curtain.
First of all, it took me a second to remember who he was. And then second of all, dude, I spent all of Saturday drinking at a party, so don't ask me.
That was 48 hours ago now, Jack.
But it was aggressive. My second party was Halloween, and then this was the follow-up Halloween party because we had people who wanted to have a Halloween party, but there was a scheduling conflict with actual Halloween. So,
I know. It was one of those lawyer parties where there was like absinthe and who knows.
It was a total nerd party. I think I'm pretty sure everybody there was a major league gamer or of some sort. Not that wasn't the party I was at on actually Halloween. It was just different types of nerds. I don't really know that many non-nerds, so that's...
Well, you know me and James.
As I was saying, I don't really know that many non-nerds.
What are you saying? I'm shocked and dismayed by that sentiment. All right. I'm
shocked to find that gambling is going on in this establishment.
Shocked. Okay, well, we covered those questions. We had a request to do some slam attacks. We'll be addressing that when we do the actual play, hopefully tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we'll be able to get into the game tomorrow through Thursday, but we'll try and get together and record it sometime soon. But it may be delayed till next week, but we'll have to see when we can get everybody together. But as far as the slam attacks, go ahead, Jack. What were you saying?
I got to say I'm looking forward to having fun with all that too, because that's playing the martial arts guy in the game right now. It's like I'm kind of like it's always fun to be able.
Well, one of the things I'm, and I'll kind of spoil this for everybody by giving a little idea of what they can expect. But one of the things that I haven't really done in the podcast yet is really take advantage of the minions rules and how you can use minions to really create a big spectacular scene without really increasing the threat level too much. So it's kind of a fun way of giving the players a chance to cut loose because they can use routine checks to attack and things like that. So there's a lot of opportunity there for role play and, simulate a lot of the more big crowd scenes in comics. And then, of course, just to set stage for something bigger.
I have a question for you, James, which is also, it's kind of one, I actually wanted to know it. But two, I'm always interested because I know that John Lighthouser and Steve both have different. They're both the rules are both compatible for either one of these interpretations, but I know they have different interpretations of the using the various maneuvers. And just for folks who might not who are listening, the idea of can you put, for example, can I do an all out power attack? Or can I do obviously there are going to be certain combos you just can't make work because you're subtracting the same, you're adding and subtracting the same thing. But
I can't think of any maneuvers that are actually contradictory.
I think I was assuming there were, but I think actually you're right. There are.
But I think that would be, too much overlap. I think they got rid of a lot of that. But as far as I know, having not actually been in a game with him, but I think I'm actually more of a Steve Kenson GM, where to me it's far more about giving the players a chance to do what they're trying to do rather than, use the rules as some sort of stumbling block in a tactical, necessity. So I have no problem with somebody trading off using all out attack and combining that with another movie. Again, it goes back to a lot of what I used to do in Hero, where you could do like a pushed haymaker and things right. like that. I want people to be able to try and come up with creative combinations of things as long as it's not breaking the power level. I don't see it as being, you know, a technical issue. I don't think it really, you know, being basically what these different effects do is they allow you to trade points from one thing to another. Right. And I don't think that them handing like all that attack basically takes from your defense to your attack bonus. And then power attack takes from your attack bonus to damage. And I just consider it, well, if you're dropping your defense to boost your damage, it's basically a big haymaker just trading from one to the other to the other.
Well, I'd actually, the example I've been having, you know, when people ask me about it myself, because I tend to go this, I tend to favor your approach, is I actually have been using lately the example of Green Arrow and other archers a lot. And I'd said, look, you know, if the guy stands there, if you've got a guy who's that good of a marksman, whether it's Deadshot or Green Arrow or whoever, and if he's going to aim at a vulnerable point, you know, a very vulnerable point to do a lot of damage, thus, you know, in game terms, he's doing a power attack. And he's going to stand there and he's going to stop and he's going to concentrate and he's going to aim, which, I mean, in addition to being the actual aim maneuver, you might also just say is an all-out attack. He's trading his defense to aim. I mean, you know, the comics seem to me to suggest to me that more often than not, you should just be able to do that. You know, you should be able to sort of make
that happen. Yeah, I like that interpretation. I do like that interpretation. One thing that points out to me, reminds me, I've been seeing this chatter on the think tank as well, but for those who don't read it, somebody's, you know, a lot of people have been asking where is sneak attack, and really, sneak attack, you can just use, I mean, I actually heard another creative solution to it, but, you know, I think Jack's option was to just use power attack, which is really good, but another option.
If you've got a guy who, sorry, I was going to say, if you've got a guy, if you've got a guy who basically can't detect you, he's not going to be able to defend against you very well. And exactly. I mean, and so as a result, you know, you can especially when you look back at the old, and I mean, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but if I recall correctly, the old sneak attack was basically for each level you had was a +2, to damage. If I remember correctly, that was what it was. That's now, I think that's right. And nowadays, I mean, that's a basic power attack. You don't even need the power attack advantage. You can get a +2 just by hitting a guy who doesn't see you coming, going ahead and taking the penalty to hit, but having that being balanced out by the fact that he has no idea you're there. You know, you're going to get the drop on him. And I think that's I think there's a lot of fun to be had with that. I mean,
I saw another solution that was kind of clever. I thought that was an interesting use of the rules. But and as far as I can see, it's not too unbalanced. But somebody used favorite environment.
Oh yeah,
favorite environment stealth.
And that's actually that is pretty creative. And actually, I like that. If you want to do like an ambush style fighter, I mean, it's not very standard superheroic, but I can certainly, like, if you're doing like a ninja or something, and you play, you know, or like Sam Fisher is like your inspiration for a superhero character or whatever. That's actually, no, I like that. That is, I hadn't considered that myself, but that is actually, I've seen some fairly wacky favorite environments, but that's actually, or alternatively, you could also do a favorite opponent.
Right.
Guys who don't, right. my favorite opponent are guys who have not detected me. I mean, and obviously.
No, those are always my favorite opponent.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, of course, the question, you know, like so many of those things, I mean, they thought I'd tell you when you're doing them, you know, you know, the GM's got to approve that stuff. And I could see a GM saying, well, that's, you know, you're playing a guy who's invisible and that's always going to come up. And, you know, that seems like for one point, maybe you're getting a bit much. Why don't you just go ahead and take power attack? But I've also found that, you know, from what I've seen so far of DC, I mean, the game is, it can handle a lot of that sort of GM. Actually, one of the things I like so much about it is it can handle a lot of GM tweaking. I mean, you can have, you know, literally have two developers on the project and designers on the project who even have a different view of what they prefer to use in terms of maneuvers in the game. And they both work. I mean, I've done it both ways and they both work. I mean, I have a personal preference, but I mean, that's just gaming. I mean, everybody's got personal preferences. You know, there was somebody asked me recently about, healing in games. Like, you know, not that Masterminds has that big of a deal about it, but people ask me about with games like Pathfinder and D&D, and I admit that, you know, for years now, I just kind of hand wave a lot of that and say, okay, some time has passed and you're mostly healed. And there are other people that really want to track those injuries. They want to go for the drama of being, you know, the character is injured and he's hurt and he has to recover. And, I think it's just a lot of it is personal taste. You know, I think there's a lot of seeking to have the one, I mean, which is, you know, the thing I keep saying when people ask about the heroes and villains build and somebody's like, you know, I can't believe you gave this character that. It's like, well, you know, I've read a lot of these comics and I certainly read a lot of them leading up to, you know, the interpretations of these comics, and everybody has, you know, not everybody's going to, you're not going to get the exact, identical build even from the same designers, but, you know, we know what we're doing. So, I mean, I say with confidence.
One thing that I noticed today, I was actually going over some characters, actually one character in specific that a player had submitted to me, and I was looking over it, and I went, well, this sounds like you're gaming the system, and I pointed out, you know, to them the problem. It's like, it sounds a little, you know, fuzzy there. And he goes, oh, well, I was just using the example from the book. And I'm like, what? And I flipped to the page, and I'm like, sure enough, there's the power exactly as he had it written. I'm like, well, there, that shoots down my objection. So there's a lot of things in there. The game can handle a lot more than sometimes even I give it credit for.
Oh yeah, I mean, I freely admit, I actually, one of the characters I was working on for Heroes and Villains, I looked at his history, and it wasn't, I will use an example of who it wasn't, but this will give you an idea maybe what I'm talking about. He was a guy kind of like Magog, who was, you know, he was kind of a combat monster. He comes in and he's all about hitting people very hard, and he's doing a lot of damage, and it's not about subtlety, and it's also certainly not about any sort of creative, like, it's hard to look at that character and think that if you think of him in game terms that he is not sort of twinked out and min-maxed, you know, on purpose. Like, that's part of his whole thing as a character. And I was working on the character, and I was building the character, and this, you know, again, not him, but a character similar to him, and I was looking at him going, wow, I really need to make this guy a combat monster. Like, to make him actually fit the concept that he is in DC Comics. I need to make this thing that as a game master, I kind of tend to resist, but I was like, no, he needs to be that, you know, that is actually kind of what his, you know, his thing is. And I think, you know, the reverse is also sometimes true, you know, where you're saying, you know, maybe you're like, wow, this is even maybe a bit suboptimal even for me. You know, maybe because, and I think you see this sometimes with characters who, when you're adding up their defenses and their attacks, they don't quite, you know, you're like, wow, this guy's really, he's like a power level 8 character, even though he's power level 10. But then you've got this one power you gave him that's incredibly versatile, like shapeshift or whatever. And I think that there's definitely that it can go the other way too, where you look at a character and go, really? I mean, he doesn't seem like he's that potent. And then you realize that he's got like a variable power or some pool of points that lets him just, you know, be the guy that he is in the comics, or be the guy he is in sort of your head, how you want to do it. And I've said before, it's like it's a mix of like, it's a weird mix of like art, science, craft, and, you know, personal taste. And, you know, everybody does it a little bit differently. And I've certainly learned some neat tricks from looking at other people's builds. And I like to hope to think that they've learned some stuff from what I've done too. So it's kind of always nice to see that.
I don't know that they're going to do this. As a matter of fact, I expect they won't, probably because, you know, for limitations of time and editing and whatnot. I think it would be kind of interesting, though, if they managed to include a byline by each character, so you can kind of get an idea of that particular writer's style in writing up, statting up characters.
Yeah,
but it was kind of like when we did the Scarecrow podcast. And I find out, you know, who had actually written him. I don't have his name handy in front of me. I think it's Leon Chang, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Yeah. And then he popped onto the forums and sent me a message. And I'm like, oh, that's you. Right. And I instantly clicked, and I'm like, oh, I see the design simplicity. And I'd see exactly, because I've been watching his builds for years, right, on the roll call.
What's his forum name is Tellison?
Yeah, I think it's okay to say that. I hope he doesn't come in and say, hey, why did you publicize me?
Yeah, so he's Tellison.
He's one of the guys that I've been watching his builds for like the better part of the existence of Mutants and Masterminds. Mm-hmm. And always he's very prolific, and so it was kind of like I instantly saw his style once I knew who was building it, and I'd like to kind of see that, you know, it'd be neat to see the bylines and see who, you know, like which ones Chris McLaughlin did, which ones Jack Norris did, you know, all that stuff. But I don't know if they're going to actually.
I don't think they will be, but I'm not sure. But I don't think so. I that's kind of the other reason why I was sort of, you know, kind of volunteered to put myself out there a little bit. And, you know, when the book comes out, I mean, you know, maybe like get on here or whatever and just go through, you know, I worked on this guy. Let's talk a little bit about what, you know, what, why the character, you know, here's what I liked about the character. Here's what I thought worked. You know, here's my philosophy. I mean, I kind of did this with my Catman. Anybody who read that'll know, you know, I definitely had an approach that wasn't universal. I mean, and I'm not saying my approach is better or hopefully not worse, but, you know, it wasn't universal. I mean, one of the first things I did was I wrote everybody's, I wrote the non-stat stuff first. And that was, I mean, I did that before I even touched the stats. And, you know, some people don't do that. And that's fine. You know, that's totally cool. And I think you're, and you know, plus I was very much looking at it from a standpoint of, I did a lot of verses and compare and contrast with the builds that we had access to. And, you know, I was honestly, I mean, I would say that, you know, I'm not saying, obviously I looked at the rules too, but I would say that a lot of times when I was building the characters, you know, if you told me, I'm going to give you the rules or I'm going to take away, you know, the stats for Batman or whatever, there's part of me that would have been like, I mean, I would have needed the rules to do it right, but there was a part of me that would have like said, you know, can I just look at the rules one last time? And then, you know, give me the stats, because that was sort of the way that I sort of tended to do, you know, look at the characters, you know, trying to sort of say, well, if Superman's this, then this guy's that, you know, if you know, kind of going from the benchmarks and everything a lot more. And I mean, not to say that everybody didn't look at the benchmarks, because everybody did. But I mean, that was just my personal, you know, methodology of it. And also, you know, with a little bit of, I have my own little weird, you know, comic alchemy to it too. Like if I saw two characters fight in a comic that when I was researching stuff and it was a relatively even match, but it was in a guy's comic, his own comic, I might go, you know, all things being equal, he might actually theoretically be a little bit weaker if I see other evidence that he is, because everybody wins in their own comic, you know? And so there was a little bit of sort of genre awareness stuff that I was doing too, that maybe not necessarily everybody did. And I think that's one of the things I really liked about working on this project and also working with the people that, you know, everybody was involved with, is everybody had their little strengths and their little weaknesses. And I think we all complimented each other and worked together. I mean, obviously if I had a question about the Golden Age, I'm going to be like, you know, Chris, tell me, help me. You know, but if somebody wants, yeah.
Quick question for you on the actual, you know, creation, another peek behind the curtain, if it's not, you know, sure. Inappropriate to say. About how many contributing writers were working on this?
Oh, geez. You know, at one point I actually looked it up and now I can't remember, but it was quite a few. I mean, I think we had a few more on two than we did on one, but I can't, but that might be, I might actually have those reversed. I mean, we're probably talking around a dozen, maybe. I want to say that's about right. It might be a little more, it might be a little less. But obviously,
to get it done in a reasonable time frame.
Yeah, we're talking 300 some characters, you know, and obviously everybody did about the same, as I understand, and again, I'm just, you know, this is me just sort of talking here, so I might be off. You know, the work was pretty evenly split with, you know, guys like Steve and stuff, maybe, you know, doing a little bit more because they were doing a lot of the benchmark stuff. But, you know, obviously, if you actually looked at the list, I think you people would be like, well, you know, this guy only did a couple things, but then you realize that of the couple things he did, you know, he did an 8-page entry on a super team or whatever. It's like, you know, if you only, you know, so if you looked at the list of the characters, you might go, oh, well, this guy only did a few. But then if you actually start looking, you say, well, yes, but that entry has 7 characters in it, or, you know, or what have you, you know, whereas somebody else might have a bunch. You know, for my first, for example, my first, for volume one, less volume two, but volume one, if you looked at my list of volume one and my list of volume two, you'd think, wow, you know, you did a lot more in volume one than you did in volume two. But in reality, you know, the, it was similar amount of work, and there are actually, I think, a few more characters in Volume 2 because I had a couple multi-part entries. So, you know, there's that too. So, I mean, I think, like I said, I've got a list somewhere, but I'm not going to tell people what it is.
I was just mainly curious as a ballpark. The volume of work, it seemed like it's a really big project, and I was just curious as to how many, you know, people had been involved because it seemed like it came together really quick.
Another interesting thing with that is it's the first, and then recently worked on the Watchtower Report for Smallville, have been two of the projects in recent event times when I have actually found myself really, I'll explain what I mean by it. I'm really glad I went to law school, and not so much for any sort of legal issues or whatever, but one of the things you learn in law school is when you're writing legal memos and stuff, but as I'm sure anybody who's ever written memos for like their boss, regardless of whether you're a lawyer or whatever, a lot of times the guy higher up the end, if he wants you to write a memo, if he says he wants a one page or a two page memo, he doesn't want a 5-page memo. You know, even if you have to glaze over some stuff, even if you have to really boil it down to some language, he wants, you know, a page. And, you know, with trying to just squeeze as much value as we can into books like this, as many characters and as much information as possible, you know, we did a lot of that. And so there was a lot of this times where, you know, I would, you know, people would ask me, it's like, oh, you only wrote, you know, if somebody looked at it and said, well, geez, you only wrote like, you know, 300-400 words on this character. It's like, I could have written 2,000, but that wasn't, you know, we only had a page. So yeah, make this character cool in 300 words. Okay. You know, cool. And yet, you know, obviously not everybody gets the same amount of words, but still, you know, I've got, you know, Superman's not going to get the same amount of words as like Bug-Eyed Bandit or whatever.
Yeah, any idea if they're going to be advertising DCA at all in the comic books? Because I'm seeing ads for DC Universe Online and a few other anniversary products.
You know, I haven't heard anything, and I got to admit, I mean, obviously, I think there's an element of, you know, obviously, you know, ads have to be paid for, and, you know, they can make a lot of money getting paid. I do admit, and, you know, I'm hopeful that maybe we'll hear some more commentary. That's always been a weird thing with games, and I'm even going to go back actually a step back to, you know, back when Adventure came out from White Wolf Games, and Warren Ellis did that opening story that he did. He wrote the opening story for Adventure, and, you know, people were all excited about it, and, you know, here he is at the time doing Planetary. And, you know, I never heard any mention of it, not in Planetary, not in the letter column, not like in, I mean, and it's possible he mentioned it somewhere. I just didn't see it.
I think I mentioned it on his blog, but yeah, Warren Ellis, I'm pretty sure if you buy him a case of Red Bull, he'll write something for you.
Right.
Warren Ellis has actually been on my live journal.
Yeah. But,
I criticized Warren Ellis, one of his columns on Wired in my live journal, and I've had like 4 commentators ever. But Warren Ellis, I was to Google his name because he showed up because Mike Lafferty talked shit about him to say, hey, what's wrong with you, Yank? That's not right. Go back and reread it. You're stupid. So that's.
But I'm hoping we'll see some, you know, but I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I always wish we'd get more of that, and I think sometimes I think it's simpler than it is. I mean, I keep hoping that like somebody will just be like, you know, like Jeff Johns will be looking over our stuff to see if we screwed anything up and be like, you know, we'll pop out of Twitter going, hey, I'm looking at this RPG thing for DC, looks pretty cool, you know, or whatever.
It just seems like it'd be a good opportunity. I mean, both ways. I mean, obviously we could use the publicity on the RPG side, but I mean, also it's something that, you know, maybe some comic book readers want to know about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the gaming industry as a whole has an interesting sort of mix of we really kind of, and it's, and I also think that, and I'm not saying this, I'm not actually quite the, I think Green Ronin does a really good job of trying to promote itself and get itself out there, but I think as an industry as a whole, not any one particular person or but just sort of like an industry culture, we have this weird mixture of really, really wishing there were more gamers so we could have an easier time putting games together and having more money for games and more people playing. And then I think there's also an element of sort of like we kind of shout it from the rafters very quietly. So it's kind of this sort of thing where it's like, you know, we're like, yeah, come on, play games because they're really fun, guys. And, you know, we should really do. I mean, you're kind of just, you know, it kind of becomes that sort of, you know, like you're auditioning for the market's attention and it's like the most like, you know, you're all excited, but you don't have a lot of confidence. And I don't know how much of that has to do with, I don't know how much of that comes up with stuff like this. In fact, I think it might even be a completely separate issue. But yeah. I definitely think that there's a real, you know, time where I meet people who are, you know, and I see it, you know, every time I go to a Gen Con or a convention, you know, you'll meet people who are just really, really talented in some cases, and really, you know, motivated, real passionate about what they do. But you know, there's also sometimes, and I think creative people can be like this, they can be really fragile. And you have to be, you know, you get that wrong encouragement at the wrong time, and you kind of shrug your shoulders and go, okay, well, you know, sorry. And I think there's a lot of folks like that in gaming. You know, Lord knows I've, you know, I'm a smug dick, so I'm not. But, you know, a lot of people are, you know, but a lot of people, you know, are, you know, they're very soft-spoken, and they're very, you know, they don't want a lot of attention. And to be fair, I think fan culture sometimes is intimidating too, because, you know, you get people online who are like, you know, you put out a supplement to a game, or you write a, you know, an OGL supplement, or you write out a game, or whether it's your own personal game, you work with somebody, or you know, you finally get your chance to write that game, you've been doing fan stuff and you really want to write a book, and then, you know, you people are just calling for your head. And I think that there's definitely, you know, I've seen people be like, wow, what, you know, what, you know, what do I just, you know, you don't have to like what I do, but geez, you know, you get kind of personal there. And, you know, and again, not that gamers are special in that regard. I mean, I think that's just the internet.
I think what you have to understand about the internet is, someone on Boing Boing once called it the bored at work network. And, yeah. Well, what really sparks when you're bored at work and you're just surfing the net, anything nasty, you know, criticism or, you know, slanderous gossip about celebrities, that's what draws you in, and that's kind of what
I have seen people say things about, you know, people that I am positive they don't even know, you know, based on, like, you know, reading, like, you know, and in some cases, like, I mean, not even reading, like, they heard about something, they heard from a friend of a friend that this movie was terrible or this book wasn't very good, or, you know, they leafed through something in a store, and the level of negativity is just, it's kind of shocking. I mean, it's really kind of a you know, it's funny because you'll get all, I mean, well, on the flip side, you'll get all like, oh man, you know, geez, people suck. But then, you know, it'll turn around and you'll have somebody just be fantastic. You know, every once in a while I'll get a message just out of the blue from somebody who, you know, oh, I picked up this book and, you know, book yours, I just want to tell you, I really enjoyed it and it's really great. Me and my group were having a great time with it. And I mean, you know, that stuff's just fantastic. It's always great to hear that from folks and, you know, be, you know, you want people to, you know, like your stuff and have, you know, get some value out of it. And, you know, and again, they don't have to, it doesn't have to be perfect. They don't have to like everything, you know, that you do. And, you know, obviously I wouldn't expect that to happen, but, you know, I also think there's a little bit of the, I also feel a little bit sometimes like the, I do admit sometimes I get a little prickly because I get the whole, like, you know, so what have you been doing? Sort of, you know, attitude too, where I'm, you know, I don't get a lot of this sort of, you know, really negative reaction from a lot of the other folks working in the industry. And by working in the industry, I mean something just as simple as like guys who do like convention support or whatever, you know, just tend to, even most of those folks tend to be really, you know, just real nice, and, or even active forum participants who try to give some value added to a, you know, to a forum where they're like, you know, hey, I'm going to post my builds for characters or whatever. I mean, I think it's always that sort of handful of really, really angry people. And I always, you know, I feel kind of bad too, because, you know, as a writer, you want to give them, you want to give them their customers too. You want to give them what they want. And sometimes what they want is like, you look at it and go, I can't give you that, because you apparently want some sort of like Shakespearean pound of flesh. And I just am not in the position to offer that up. So,
I just wish there was a way you could press a button on your keyboard and instantly like dispense Prozac to someone on the other end of a forum. that would be perfect, I think. James, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just kind of, you know, steering a little bit back towards, the game system a little bit, because, you know, I noticed we're running a little.
We could go ahead and wrap up if that's okay with you guys. Yeah,
I was gonna comment or ask, actually. It's something I've been asking people who like the system, because I've been seeing a lot of people who've been, you know, mouthing off about what they don't like, and I don't mean that in a negative way. Just, you know, they've been speaking out loudly about things.
They've been focusing on the negative. Yeah.
But I was just curious, Jack, what your favorite thing is about the new system, what your favorite change is. Because I've been – one of the things that to me has struck me – when I originally saw the system, my favorite thing was the fact of going to a rank and measure table. Mm-hmm. But over time, I've seen a lot of emergent behavior in the rules that surprised me at how many of the little tweaks really mm-hmm. changed. So I was wondering what your favorite thing is so far.
I'll have to give you like a top three because the favorite thing, and if I say that immediately, I'll be done. I'll go, wait, I forgot to say this. I love the ranks and measures table. I really do. I think it's like it has the thing that I liked about the old DC Heroes RPG for Mayfair, which uh-huh. was the ability to, you know, you kind of learn this, you kind of get used to it. You know, you have like a piece of paper in front of you, basically a chart or whatever, and you can just give such quick, you know, answers to people on things like how can I lift this? Yeah. How far can I throw it? You know, questions that I think come up a lot also for, you know, newer gamers more so than older gamers. Older gamer might read this, you know, they might know the throwing rules backwards and forwards in an earlier edition of the game. But, you know, you get a guy, you're sitting down at a con or you're sitting down just for, you know, a friend who's going to play and you're like, so I'm Superman, right? Awesome. So I'm like really strong. Yeah. Well, how strong am I? It's like, okay, well, this is how much you can lift. That's cool. So like, what can I do? You know, so what if I like picked up this car and I wanted to throw it? How far could I throw it? And be able to get those sort of fast reactions to things are cool. And I really like that a lot. And I think it does speed up play. I am a big fan of the sort of narrativization of the statistics. I know not everybody agrees. I know some people would have preferred to keep attack and defense and et cetera. I love the fighting stat. I love that the stats have kind of gone away from the base 10 plus of D20. And have gone to the straight bonuses and also have gone to the, more, I mean, I don't want to say more descriptive, but, cause I don't think it's necessarily true. Cause I mean, strength, constitution and stuff are descriptive. But you know, I feel like a little bit when I'm looking at the stats that I'm, when I'm going back to, you know, reading the old, you know, the various, who's who's and the Marvel stuff, not so much the earliest ones, but the ones that they came out later where they tried to give, you know, ranks to things. A lot of the current Marvel Universe stuff is like that. They've got like, you know, strength and, you know, speed and everything and they've got little number, you know, little graph you can compare them to. I really kind of dig that. I mean, even like the old, like back of the Transformers box growing up, you know, you'd see the little cards would have everybody on there. I like that. I like that quite a bit. And I think then like my other thing that I really didn't like, this was something that came out more in play, is all the things that have been removed from being special and they're just things you can do and they're more special if you focus on them. And the combat maneuvers are probably the best example of that. You know, that here everybody can power attack now. If you have the advantage, you can do a really great power attack. But you know, everybody can pull back the fist and do a haymaker. You know, Lois Lane doesn't need power attack to, you know, clock some guy who's getting fresh with her. She can do that without having to have it on her sheet. And I really like that a lot. And I think it also goes to sort of the whole, I think there's a lot of standardization in that regard, which has been really fun. I kind of feel that, I mean, this is not really the same, but I feel like it feels related to me in my head, sort of the, complications and hero point stuff was always in there, but by really moving it to the forefront, it's sort of everybody's got complications and everybody's got, you know, things that get them hero points. I feel like that mechanism is more universal. I mean, it was always there before for characters, but now it just feels more like, you know, by saying to people, look, you're all going to have these things and we're all going to use them in the system. Is going to have these. So I'm a really big fan of all that. I mean, and then obviously setting aside the system stuff for a second, I mean, I just adore that it's a DC Comics like license game. I mean, I'll freely admit that. I mean, I'm just, that's, you know, I'm a child of two tribes. So if it had been a Marvel game, I would have been just as thrilled. But I definitely like that just made me so excited. And, you know, I still think that was such a great, like, just feeling to get that email, you know, when it's like, you want to work on this project? And I was like, yes. And then when I found out, like, the news on what it was, I was just like, no way. I mean, I honestly was like, you know, looking for the hidden camera and seeing, like, you're pranking me, aren't you? Like, seriously. Like, I'm going to be unpunked or something or candid camera or depending on how old you are. But no, so, yeah, I mean, I think, but I would say, like, first and foremost, I really love the ranks and measures, but I also kind of love the move, while keeping the parts about the game I really liked, the move away from making it less a D20 game and more of its own game.
Okay.
And I don't know, and then there's things that like I love, but I can't be, but I can't be too, I keep forgetting to do it because I'm still on old habits. So I love the whole, you know, narrate after the roll thing. So I mean, I adore that. I think that's a great idea. But I keep not doing it. So I have to break myself of that habit, but I love it. I encourage everybody else to try it, including myself, because apparently I need constant encouragement to try it.
We'll try to wrap that in next podcast. Yeah. James, same question to you, I guess, is what part of DCA do you?
I think I kind of mentioned it in my asking the question, but you know, the first thing that struck me, of course, was I was always a big fan of the DC Heroes game, specifically for the rank and measure, or what they called the AP measure table. And you know, it was the one thing about the system that kept me coming back to it, despite the fact that the way that you rolled dice in that system was very GM tiresome. I mean, basically every time somebody rolled dice, I had to look at a chart, I had to look at tables, and I had to work everything out myself and tell them how many column shifts they got, blah, 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 which basically distracted from me being able to then be, you know, have my creative portion of my brain working on something else to like react to what they were doing. Whereas the strict D20 plus a modifier just makes things so much simpler. So I like Mutants and Masterminds better in that regard, and giving it that measure table for me was awesome. But as far as a change from a previous edition, I think that and I love the term emergent behavior just because it makes me sound so smart. But it's all these little tweaks that they've made, and Jack covered a bunch of them. But, you know, to me, if I were trying to walk up to somebody with second edition Mutants and Masterminds and teach them how to play it, it would be so much more helpful to me if they were already a gamer, one, and two, already played D20, so they knew a lot of the stuff. Mm-hmm. With third edition, it's actually just as easy to teach a completely new gamer as it would be to teach somebody who is a fan of one of the other systems I mentioned, like, you know, D&D or whatever. I can teach a new gamer, you know, more easily. Thanks to the plain English language, and by taking, you know, because the old system had, you know, the original system, you had the D20 inheritance of modifiers from your stats adding into your combat stats. And then in second edition, they divorced that to bring in, you know, more rigid power balance. And in third edition, they've kind of integrated everything back into the stats in a much more clean and elegant fashion. And I think it's just so much easier. It's like somebody goes, well, how do I make a really good martial artist? Give him a high fighting skill. Oh, is that it? Pretty much. You can fine tune it from there. But that basis just makes it so much easier for somebody to sit down and go, okay, well, this is what I want to do. And I'm like, okay, well, this is how you do it. And it's, I think, a far easier game to teach than second or first edition were.
I kind of briefly got to see what before I lose the thread. I think this might be what James is saying. And I also, because I want to say something smart too, because I agree with the emergent behavior. I think it's a game that definitely seems that, in my impression, that it rewards mastery without punishing being a novice.
Yeah.
If you get good at making characters and playing with the power system and playing with the advantages and stuff, you can do some really fantastic things. But I don't feel like new players are punished. Like, I don't feel like right. that there's a. I feel like they're not. You know, maybe they don't have the nuances of all their characters quite the way that maybe an experienced player might have. But I don't feel like it's as – I really feel like it does on some level. And obviously, I mean, it is a little bit of a sliding scale. I think that there's no perfect balance there. But I do think that, like, that's the impression I get. I hear a lot of people who have played in games at demos and whatever, and it's like, you know, two veteran players and a friend who's never even heard of the game all sit down to play. And at the end of the day, they're all like, oh, that was awesome. And everybody had a good time. And, you know, everybody felt like their character. And, you know, everybody felt like, you know, hey, I was playing Batman and I felt like Batman. You know, that seemed like stuff Batman could do, you know. And then somebody else turned around and said, you know, maybe they were looking at it more for the rules changes because they were a big second ed fan. And said, oh, I really like that I can do power attacks and all this other stuff now before. And I think it's really a neat thing, you know, that it doesn't punish the novice, but it also rewards the veteran, which I think is a good. And you know, obviously, you know, not everybody's going to like the rewards. I mean, there's, you know, there is going to be a definite level of personal taste, but yeah.
Yeah.
So, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. I was just thinking. I was kind of that thought you were saying all these things, and I was like, yeah, yeah. And then I just sort of thought of that. I'm going to throw that in there too before I forget.
Primarily, what I mean by emergent behavior is basically that a lot of the little changes, I think, create a. You know, it's like when I first looked at the damage, I'm like, oh, okay, well, they don't have two damage tracks. That's going to be handy. And then I looked at a healing, and I'm like, well, that's kind of funky. They've changed that up a lot. And then I looked at these other things. And then I started looking at everything as part of the big picture once we started gaming. And I'm like, oh, wow, this game is so much harder to kill somebody in. I can really cut loose with the bad guys a lot more without worrying about pissing off players, you know. I can put them up against, you know, steeper competition without accidentally killing someone.
Right.
And, you know, and I don't have to fudge the die rolls nearly as much to make up the difference, you know, between a player having a poor die roll and, you know, and a, you know, an NPC rolling a critical hit or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, when you're putting somebody up against, you know, there's some degree where I'm, you know, I will freely admit I'm a nice guy GM. I'm not the guy who's stacks odds against the players. Now, some GMs out there are much more. It's a tactical exercise for them. And I think this kind of frees up the player to really cut loose and have more fun. But again, it's a lot of little changes that each by itself kind of looks a little odd and maybe even awkward. But when I start combining them and seeing how they all affect the big picture, it really does make it a much different game. I mean, little tweaks all over the place that completely change the experience. I mean, it's obviously still a tabletop role-playing game, but, you know, it's to some degree, it's just, I think it's that attention to detail and that much work that they put into it. It's obvious that there is a lot of stuff in there that, and there's stuff in there that I still would have done differently, but, you know, that's cool. I can definitely work with. You know, a lot of people complain that this or that isn't perfect, but for me, there is no such thing as a perfect game. But for me, the closest thing to perfection is a game where I have to make fewer than 10 house rules. And so far with, you know, this game system, there's only really two house rules I've been working on, and they're simply just, you know, number flips. You know, I mean, my personal house rules, you know, I think I talked to Jack about, yeah, I know I talked to Jack about this because we were talking about it. You know, we were yakking it up after Gen Con for hours, but one is, instead of doing the half toughness impervious thing where you divide your toughness by half to see what you can use your imperviousness against, I just, you know, let people use impervious as a routine check if their toughness is a routine check up to their impervious ranks in it, and that effectively, I mean, for power level 10, it's no different than the game version. It only makes it different if you go up or down from power level 10. And I think it's just a little more, I don't know, it kind of makes the math a little invisible, and it makes the player feel like, well, you know, I'm, you know, 'cause a lot of players got that shock of, you know, wait, I'm paying for 10 ranks of impervious, but I'm only getting to use 5, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it kind of helps ameliorate that somewhat. But the other house rule is just a simple, I don't like, in a system where everything's kind of exponential, I don't like dividing things in half. So whenever something calls for, you know, a defense minus or divided by 2, I usually do it as a defense minus 5 instead.
To a negative 5, which is what most of the penalties are anyway.
Yeah.
I think the only one I've, like, and James kind of mentioned that, my sort of house rule, and I mean, I even kind of think this is almost just like a weird reading of the rules, but I guess if not everybody does it, it's a house rule. Is, you know, they talk about how, you know, routine checks are for when you're in a non-stressful situation, and my take on toughness checks are, certain toughness checks are just not stressful. You know, there are certain, like, where it's like, you know, Superman getting shot is not stressful, and he gets to do a routine check on his toughness. And I kind of don't care how big of a pistol, you know, the thug's got. You know, if unless it's a kryptonite bullet, I take that as a routine check. And I think some people look at the routine check and say combat is always stressful. And I look at it more and say, well, it's usually stressful, except, you know, if it's a minion shooting at, you know, Superman or whatever, you know, or Wonder Woman, like, oh, I'm going to get shot. You know, you're pointing a pistol at Wonder Woman. Good luck.
Yeah. But I mean, I haven't been using my house rules in the podcast games, and I will continue to use the DC rule raw, you know, rules as written for the podcast games, just because the whole point is to try and share with the audience, right, you know, how the rules officially work. But, you know, obviously, you know, it's one of those things that really doesn't need to be said, but it does. That your game master may vary, you know. It's like, yes, you've got completely different people. Like, I think it was Mr. Morrison made a comment on one of the threads we were talking about, whether, you know, when he felt that certain powers had inherent drawbacks that, you know, like, for example, an immunity. I think the discussion was about immunities. And we were discussing, you know, whether or not an immunity to magic, you know, as written in the character, would prevent somebody from casting a healing spell. And basically I said, well, that depends on a lot of things, but if it did, I would reward a hero point for a complication.
Yes.
And he, on the other hand, and he said, no, I don't think it's worth a hero point because it's in the descriptors. And I'm like, you know, that's an entirely GM judgment thing. You know, right, that's right. Definitely going to set the tone for your game, is how you make those little decisions. And I'm just the kind of guy who would give the hero point because I'm thinking if that's complicating the matters and making life difficult for the character, I'm going to give him a hero point. It's just
I know we're getting ready to wrap here because we're running kind of long. But I, you know, I kind of wanted to throw out an example of that too. And this is, I think, another good example. Actually, I'm going to use an example from DC Comics because, you know, it seems appropriate. There was a period of time back in the, I think it was the early 90s, late 80s, Power Girl actually got severely injured in a fight. And it was an internal injury, if I remember correctly. I don't remember if it was Mystical or whatever, or if she just got really badly beaten and had internal injuries. And because she's, you know, got like Superman level or close to invulnerability, it was very difficult to operate on her to fix these things. And, you know, I think there's an argument there of if there's not a scalpel or something around that can cut through your super hard flesh, well, you bought the ability to not have your flesh not be cut. You know, is that just an inherent thing in your character and you don't get a complication for that? Or is it, or would it something, well, you know, if we're going to do the whole, you know, you're actually injured bad enough, you need surgery. I'm going to go ahead and give you a complication for it. And I think, you know, I think it is. It's a question of who what do you want to do as a GM? And what do you want to do what do your players want too? Because obviously that, you know, they're going to have a preference too. You know, they're going to want something. I think it's easy to assume that, you know, players are just going to always want more hero points. But actually, I think, you know, there are definitely players out there that's like, they, you know, they want to earn things for certain things. And if they aren't really so much interested in getting them for other things. And so, mm-hmm. And everybody has to have a slightly different style. And I mean, you know, looking at the history of comics, you can see, you know, there was a period of time where, you know, something like, you know, immunity to magic means you can't be healed by mystical means was almost just kind of the way things work because it was darker and grittier. And now it's like, they might kind of hand wave it, you know, depending. It's like, yeah, you're immune to magic except this beneficial magic thing because that was, you know, that's what the story has or whatever.
I mean, like, technically speaking, as a player, depending on the game I was in, if I ran into something like that, I don't think it would be markedly different for me to write down on my character sheet the word harmful in front of magic and have it cost any different. So, again, I think it's one of those things where if I'm immune to magic, you know, and somebody used it against me, I'd be like, and it didn't give me a hero point, I would, as a player, kind of feel a little frustrated and feel that inspiration to go back and adjust my character so that it didn't happen again.
Well, and I think and so often so much of that is, you know, talk to your group, you know what everybody wants, because that's going to be everybody's going to feel a little differently about that. And
everybody should, you know, definitely work that one up. All right. So,
all right, well, we're probably getting ready to wrap now, I'm guessing.
We're getting a 3-minute warning here from Mike.
Yep.
All right. So next session, we're going to be doing the actual play, and we're also, Jack's going to give us a premiere of the DCA LARP rules, right, Jack?
Yes, we are. We're all going to put on costumes and run around Chicago. Chicago's the original basis for Hub City, so I'm going to get my question mask and go beat up muggers.
I get to be the creeper.
There we go. That's we're on. We'll get you some yellow pancake makeup and a green shag carpet to throw over your back, and which, by the way, was actually what the costume was originally made of. So my final obscure comic thing.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for everyone for tuning in, and until next time, stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.